Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdropper. On today's show, the GOP platform is out, and yes, it does have a section on tech. There's a lot to like, plenty to dislike, and plenty to scratch your head at. Joining me to discuss this is Chief Technology Officer of the Republican National Committee, Baron Soka. Baron, thank you for joining the show.
Not a Republican, just for the record.
I mean, is that like a technical thing or a figurative thing or like a what's in your heart? And what do you mean?
All of the above.
So you don't believe in Republican forms of government? Is that what you're saying?
Lowercase r, yes.
So before we jump in, I thought it was interesting that last night that Ted Cruz did not endorse Donald Trump. He congratulated him on winning the nomination, but then did not endorse him. He said, vote your conscience. And it got me thinking, you know, Baron, you've congratulated me on the podcast before, but you've never actually endorsed me as a host. So are you thinking of running in 2020? Like, what's going on?
I will say to all listeners out there, if they care about their children, if they care about the future of our country, vote your conscience when it comes time to pick a new host.
Okay. And obviously we will open this up to an online vote where like 10 people vote and then that's how we decide who hosts the podcast.
Dan Benavente, our chief operating officer, has a large contingent of Peruvians who are going to vote for him.
That's true.
Just so you know.
He has the Peruvian vote locked up. Damn it. I wish I could get access to that. Well, anyway, quick take, there's a big difference between the 2016 platform and the 2012 platform, and holy shit, it uses the word broadband. That's more than we can say for 2012, right? So this shows progress.
Yep. On the other hand, they're misspelling the word internet. It's the internet, capital I, network of networks. It's the only one, but the Democrats do the same thing. So it's hard to know who to go to here just on spelling.
You know, funny enough, our colleague over at Access, Amy Stepanovich, was telling me today that she also shares the lowercase I internet because she hopes that it will lead to future internets. And she says that it's too early to be locking in the capital I, Baron. So maybe, I don't know if that changes your mind at all, but.
No, it's true that you could have a splinter net. That is definitely a thing that could happen. And we did our show yesterday about the potential for foreign governments having more influence over internet governance. And the concern there really is that China or Russia or any other oppressive country could really create their own domestic internet that would be separate from the internet. But the internet would still be uppercase I, and the Chinese repressed internet would be a lowercase I.
Just to be fair to Amy, I brought that up and she said that's not what she meant. She meant some other type of future internet. So just to be clear, but let the record show that while many have failed to influence the Republican Party platform, the AP style book has clearly gotten through to Mr. Trump and the platform writers.
And the Democrats, sadly. So you got to find a third party.
So let's jump into the platform. And I say we start with free speech because that's always a fun one. So
something near and dear to Mr. Trump's heart.
Obviously. So despite comments that Mr. Trump has made about, you know, the Amazon owning the Washington Post and going after his critics in the media and his number one fangirl, Ann Coulter, saying she wants to be FCC chair to go after media companies. The Republican platform is a little bit more measured in some ways. The platform, quote, supports free market approaches to free speech unregulated by government, end quote. So that's good, right, Baron?
Oh, yeah. Couldn't have asked for more than that. Unfortunately, there was more than that. there are two long paragraphs. And the first paragraph that begins with that sentence goes on and on and on about campaign finance reform. And it's really telling that while there are some other good things in the rest of the platform about free speech, and especially free speech in countries like Russia and China, the section about the First Amendment is really about, number one, campaign finance and the ability to spend money and that is recognized as speech. And I agree with that, but there's a lot more to free speech than just that. And then number two, that porn thing that you've probably heard about, the platform singles out pornography as, quote, a public health crisis that is destroying the lives of children.
Millions, not children.
Right.
But then it goes on to talk about children.
Right. Yeah. And you know, unlike, for example, the war on drugs, right? I mean, it's worth noting that, so as this relates to tech and as it relates to free speech, there is a real concern there, which is child pornography, right? Which is a different issue. And in the last Republican platform, that's what it talked about. The same language in this platform about child porn comes from that. But then this sentence came out of nowhere that just talks about the public health crisis, blah, blah, blah. And it's hard to know what that means exactly, but I think at a minimum, it does signal that if there were a Trump FCC, whether it was headed by Ann Coulter or some other similarly qualified person, that the FCC would certainly crack down on indecency even more than the FCC has recently. And at worst, that you might see a return to the 1996 to 1998 techno panic about the internet somehow eroding moral values and spreading pornography. And let's recall that Congress tried twice to censor the internet, and I don't think that Trump would be above trying again.
Yeah, and you can be a civil libertarian and a social conservative, and you can think that pornography is bad. I mean, the platform kind of makes it sound like, you know, we're taking a stand that pornography is bad, and anyone who disagrees is saying that it's good. It's not. That's not the point. The point is, what does government have to do with any of it? And you can easily be a social conservative who believes that pornography is harmful, and there's plenty of research to go one way or the other. But the question is that a government function? And it should be concerning to proponents of free speech that we're now treating online pornography as a public health crisis. And you make a great point. You want to talk about a public health crisis. You want to talk about why there's so many people getting shot in the street and why cops are having horrible encounters with civilians. It's the war on drugs. So there's just a little bit of hypocrisy in that the platform doesn't say anything about that, but now we've identified this real problem. You know, let's talk about real public health crises like tobacco and things like that. This is not a real public health crisis.
Yeah, and I just want to reiterate that what Congress tried first was regulating online indecency, or that was back in the 1996 Communications Decency Act. That was all struck down by the courts. And then so in 1998, Congress tried again with the Child Online Protection Act, which required essentially that websites that serve adult material, which could include anything that's remotely sensitive, any discussion of a sensitive topic, that those sites age verify all their users. And the courts struck down that law as infringing on the right to anonymous reading of material online, because if you have to age verify yourself online, you are essentially identifying yourself. So the point is that those things were unconstitutional. What we have been left with is we still police child pornography. We already have a robust mechanism for doing that. It's treated differently. It is not protected by the First Amendment. Nobody is saying that there should be more child pornography or that law enforcement shouldn't fight it. That's not a controversial issue. That's not what this is about. The platform is rather going after porn in general and signaling that there's going to be some kind of crackdown, whether from the FCC or from Congress.
Yeah, and one has to wonder what's behind it. And, you know, maybe it's that social conservatives have long been skeptical of Donald Trump. He's had problems gaining the support of the Utah Republican Party. So who knows? This could be just throwing a bone to them, regardless of whether it's a good policy position. Before we jump to the next free speech issue of the Fairness Doctrine, I just want to tease an episode we'll have next week where Federal Elections Commissioner Lee Goodman discusses with me in depth the campaign finance issue and how it's particularly important to digital platforms. So listeners, check that out next week because we'll unpack that issue with more detail. But now let's get to the Fairness Doctrine, because this is also part of the free speech bucket that we started with. And the platform calls for an end to the Fairness Doctrine. Now, of course, conservatives, those on the right, have long opposed the Fairness Doctrine because it requires broadcasters to give, quote, equal time to opposing views. While that sounds great because it's public media and sure, all viewpoints should be, you know, kumbaya, that actually stifled discussion of controversial issues in the minds of many, and it blocked development of talk radio. So the cynical response from Republicans were right to maybe be cynical and think the left only wanted the Fairness Doctrine because of the success of conservative talk radio. And they were concerned that people like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity were making a lot of money. Now, this is perplexing, though, because we haven't had the Fairness Doctrine since 1986, right, Barron? So why are we talking about this now?
Yeah, so everything you said is right, but there's a chronological element missing from that. So.
Right.
The Fairness Doctrine was in place for many years. The Reagan FCC abolished it back in 1986, and that in turn allowed the development of talk radio. So in other words, it was a form of architectural censorship that essentially kept broadcast media very anodyne and kept it in the hands of a mainstream elite that was, of course, overwhelmingly left-wing in its biases. So that was taken out. And then there was talk at the beginning of the Obama administration about reviving it, because the left has always been obsessed with this idea as well. And so in the 2008 platform, you saw the party oppose reinstatement of the Fairness Doctrine. In 2012, when that had really become no longer an issue because the FCC had finally taken the rules off the books, so it was dead. The platform was changed to say, well, we oppose the concept of the fairness doctrine as might be extended in other arenas like speech codes on campuses and so on. And then now, all of a sudden, you have someone who knows who was behind this coming along saying, well, we oppose the fairness doctrine as if it's still a live thing. And so the point here is nobody's paying attention who knows anything, because if they were, this wouldn't have been written this way. It would have said something like the last one said, of the concept still out there, it could potentially be applied. This whole thing about trigger warnings and campuses and safe spaces is sort of similar in its basic philosophical underpinnings. The platform could have talked about that. Instead, it opposed something that has been dead since 1986.
Yeah, and this could just be that it's a talking point that they like, you know, and that it doesn't matter that it's not a live policy issue. Let's just use the talking point that we like. And like you say, you could kind of tie it to other issues.
But that should tell us something. It tells us that at a minimum, Trump said a few months ago that he just wasn't interested in substance and his voters weren't interested in substance and it didn't matter to them. He'd figure it out later. So that's one explanation. And the second is, who knows? I mean, maybe he and the people he works with really are focused on that concept of fairness. Because let's not forget, he talks about how unfairly he's treated all the time.
Right.
So you could easily see this fitting into his narrative. It certainly fits into the broader narrative on the right. Remember what happened with Facebook, right? Where Facebook was accused of treating conservative sites unfairly. There's now a little controversy about Milo being taken off of Twitter.
Milo Yiannopoulos, the Breitbart tech editor.
The super thoughtful, philosophically well-grounded conservative commentator.
Yes.
Who also happens to lead digital lynch mobs.
Yes.
That guy.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's just to say that this may be a sign of things to come, of both sides returning to their ideological screaming points.
Well, just so we're keeping track of the report card, we're saying yay to the free market approach to free speech, meh on the myopic focus on campaign finance, then that whole porn thing is just a misfire, as is the fairness doctrine. Now let's move to another fun one, the sharing economy. Now there's not a whole lot about it, but they do specifically mention on-demand platforms. Quote, "We want government to encourage the sharing economy and on-demand platforms to compete in an open market. We believe public policy should encourage the innovation and competition that are essential for an Internet of Things to thrive." They go on further, quote, "We envision government at all levels as a partner with individuals and industries and technological progress, not a meddlesome monitor." So, Baron, is this essentially the Republican platform endorsing the sharing economy? Airbnb, Uber, TaskRabbit, Thumbtack, all of the ways that people are putting dead capital to use.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one where I think the tech sector has to acknowledge that Republicans are far better, far closer to their views than are the Democrats. The Democratic draft platform, we'll see what the final one says, but the draft platform says nothing on the subject. And Hillary Clinton has tried to have it both ways. She does talk about the benefits of these platforms somewhat grudgingly, and yet says things like, well, there are, quote, hard questions about workplace protection and what a good job will look like in a future. And I'll crack down on bosses who exploit employees by misclassifying them as contractors or even stealing their wages, unquote. The Democrats have been, well, not uniformly, because of course there are lots of pro-tech, pro-sharing economy Democrats, but Hillary Clinton has really taken a page from Elizabeth Warren on this and has attempted to apply the old concepts of you're either an employee or you're a contractor in the most rigid way and in a way that would really kill these platforms. I mean, the whole point of something like Uber is that you don't do it full time. It's entirely flexible. You're not punching in on a clock. And so what's unfortunate here is that both sides are missing some area for real common ground. So there are real issues to be addressed. Like, for example, how do you buy health insurance, right? Well, that's a real problem, but it's a problem only because of our tax code,
yes,
only because we tie employment to health, to being able to buy health benefits with pre-tax dollars.
And just to further that point, the independent contractor model for now is what is keeping the sharing economy going and it's key to its success. That does not mean it necessarily makes the most sense. You could see that there is a difference between a freelance plumber who does whatever the hell he wants all the time or an Uber driver who, you know, they can drive whenever they want, but they can't set the rates that they charge, right? So there are differences, but when those should be ironed out and there's talk of a third way, things like how to buy health insurance, the employment model, et cetera, but those things should be ironed out through legislation. The problem is if you take it as a binary choice, Republicans are saying yes to the thing that's working now. Democrats are saying, no, let's go to the employment model. They're not talking about a third way. And I did a previous episode with Jared on this show about
only six.
Yeah, about how Democrats divide on Uber. And the short version is Bernie said, I'm not a fan of Uber. The irony is that all his supporters are millennials who love Uber. And Hillary Clinton has been trying to toe this line where she says, yes, there are economic benefits, but the workplace classification issue needs to be answered. And clearly, if she's got Elizabeth Warren campaigning with her now, that there's going to be some influence there. And companies that are relying on 1099 worker classification now to survive should realize that in terms of just the platforms, the Republican platform is pro-sharing economy. At best, the Democratic platform is nothing or it's lukewarm. So Barron, we've got a whole list of other issues here. We might not get to all of them, but do you want to just take a pick, spin a wheel? Where do you want to take this discussion next?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think let's start with broadband. I mean, the good news is both parties recognize the importance of broadband deployment. And as you said, the word wasn't even in the Republican platform last time.
The tech platform, it didn't even use the word broadband, which is kind of like sad.
Yeah. Well, so the good news is the Republican platform really gets that you need to make deployment easier, that spectrum is especially important, and that it is especially important for rural areas where wireless solutions are going to be most important. It's really unfortunate that as with the 2012 platform, the Republican platform really singles out rural areas as if that's their only focus. Now, they could have put this differently. They could have said, look, we need to be worried about connecting all unconnected Americans. And they could have rightly noted that the digital divide is quite large when it comes to rural America, and that this FCC has really just ignored rural issues. They have consistently chosen urban deployment over rural deployment. We've talked about this in the context of an AT&T merger where they offered to deploy service to 13 million Americans, to rural Americans to connect them. And the FCC said, nope, no thanks. We want you to wire essentially elites in cities instead. So they could have focused on that, but instead the platform comes across as we only care about our voters and not people in cities. And you know, last night, Ted Cruz made a big point in his speech about focusing on the GOP as being the party of Lincoln, the party of civil rights, the party of outreach. He was channeling Jack Kemp. And if Jack Kemp had been working on the tech policy platform, he would have said, we cannot talk about rural America without at the same time talking about people in cities and especially minorities and addressing their deployment needs, which is a different set of technological problems.
Yeah, let's talk about a local problem. In DC, phone companies are trying to retire their copper networks so that they can build fiber to compete with Comcast in Washington, DC. And right now, a lot of people in urban areas in DC have one option, Comcast, and you can get fast enough service through them, but you only have really one option for internet if you want high speed, because the other option is Verizon DSL. So basically, your point is well taken that the Republican platform should not be suggesting that the job of broadband deployment in urban America is somehow finished. Yes, the FCC under the Obama administration is guilty of favoring their constituents, but now you've got the Republicans going into their corner too. So the point being, the digital divide is all over the place, and it's not just in the mountains, and it's not just in the streets, and it needs to be solved regardless of where they are or who the people who need internet happen to be voting for.
Right. So that's the good and the bad. The vague part is there's a line in there about public-private partnerships for broadband deployment. Not clear what that means. It could mean what we want, which is that governments, local, state governments, tribal governments, do everything they can to make deployment easier. That might mean, for example, installing conduits when you replace the water mains so that you can more cheaply put fiber under streets, or making poles available, or letting 5G companies deploy small cell antennas on meters, parking meters on the street, right? Those are all a kind of public-private partnership that would be great as a way to really catalyze private investment. Or it could mean the opposite. It could mean that you're having governments build out networks and then just getting the private sector to run them. And who knows? It's just too vague to tell.
Yeah, and just for listeners, I mean, it's not surprising to us. We work in tech policy. Our issue area has long been an afterthought in what is the national political discussion. So we're not exactly shocked that the platform is short on specifics. But if you're going to say things like public-private partnership, which could mean a lot of things, and then not explain it, that's kind of irresponsible. Maybe they would have been better off just leaving that term out of the platform entirely. Now, before we move on from broadband, it wouldn't be a Tech Freedom Tech Policy podcast if we didn't address the issue of net neutrality and Title II reclassification of broadband as a utility. So this is something that the Obama administration did. So naturally, you're going to expect that the platform is going to be very opposed to the form of net neutrality that was enacted, which again, the telephone style regulation on broadband. So Barron, take us through the Republican platform's approach to the thorny issue of net neutrality.
The platform rightly slams the White House for, quote, subjugating the internet to government and decrying the White House extraordinary and very politically driven intervention in the FCC's net neutrality rulemaking. And it's quite true that the president did, in fact, order the chair of the supposedly independent FCC to impose Title II, which is rules designed for the 1930s telephone monopoly. That is all 100% correct. And the platform is right to decry it. And then the interesting part. So that's all about Title II and the legal basis and the potential for more control and more regulation.
Yeah, we got plenty of episodes on that, listeners.
Yeah. But then the issue of net neutrality. So then the platform says, the internet's free market needs to be free and open to all ideas and competition without government or service providers picking winners and losers. Now, what does that mean? So again, this is so vague that, like the term net neutrality itself, you could read anything you want into that. That could mean that, and apparently there were people on the platform committee saying basically what people on the radical left have always said, that any deviation from net neutrality in the strictest sense is picking winners and losers, and the government should ban that, right? You could mean that. Or this could mean what broadband providers have always said, which is that they don't want to pick winners and losers. So it depends what we're talking about. If the program, we've talked about things like T-Mobile's Binge On, so that all the video that goes to your phone is optimized at a quality level that allows you to allows the network to work better, and then that's not counted against your data cap. Is that picking winners and losers? Well, I don't think so. It applies equally to all video providers. Take, for example, AT&T has a sponsored data program. Anyone can join to participate in that. That's not picking winners and losers. And then the third example I would give you is everyone talks about in the Verizon case, in the oral arguments, where Verizon's lawyers said, well, Your Honor, but for these arrangements, but for these rules, we would be pursuing such arrangements. And the other side has jumped up and down and said, see, Verizon's just waiting to pick winners and losers, except that what she was actually talking about was actually ESPN getting paid for its content so that ESPN would be willing to put that stuff up just on the internet so you could get it on your phone.
And ESPN's already a winner.
And the important thing is it wouldn't be Verizon picking the winner and loser. So in other words, there are lots of things that you can imagine that are not strictly neutral that are not picking winners and losers. And so you could read this to mean that in fact, this is a good way for Republicans to message this, to say, yeah, there's something that we should be concerned about, like blocking and throttling, the things that the Republican Congress voted to let the FCC do back in 2006. And so this does make me hopeful that actually we could see this unnecessarily divisive issue be resolved soon. This actually opens the door for Republicans to reach the kind of compromise that we have called for.
Yeah, and to use an even more recent example, what about when consumers pick the winners and losers and then companies react to that? So consumers picked Pokemon Go. I mean, talk about a freaking winner. I mean, Nintendo stock going through the roof, people using it all the time. And T-Mobile sees this and go, holy shit, so many people on our network are using Pokemon Go. Probably makes sense for us to zero rate this so that they don't burn through their entire data plan. Now, that is not picking a winner and loser. Consumers picked Pokemon Go as a winner. T-Mobile wants to react to that. And maybe they optimize their network. Maybe they figure out how Pokemon Go can run on a separate lane in a non-net neutrality world. But the point being, sometimes it's the consumers that are deciding that they like certain services and they want them to be free or subsidized by a company, not the companies themselves. So it's really a chicken and egg problem. You know, if Pokemon Go is already successful, then they become part of Binge On and then people start complaining about it. Can we really honestly say that T-Mobile picked the winner?
Yeah. Quite so, Evan. And let's also remember that the FCC's rules do not actually exempt user-directed prioritization. This is part of the reason that we intervene to sue the FCC, because it's crazy. If you, in the name of user empowerment, actually bar users from getting something they want, how can you justify what you're doing as being pro-consumer?
And just briefly, let's touch on an issue that directly relates to the FCC, which is the administrative state. It's basically as it relates to tech, right? So there's plenty, conservatives have complained about plenty agencies. There's EPA, IRS, SEC, take your pick. But when we're talking about tech, we're mostly talking about the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, think net neutrality, and the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, think enforcement actions, consumer protection, you know, looking at Google's data protection, things like that. And there is pending legislation, which is not referenced specifically in the platform, that would help rein in these agencies and end the almost blind deference that courts have been giving to agencies anytime there's ambiguity in statute. But Barron, if you just want to briefly say some words about the FCC administrative and constitutional law and how the GOP platform approaches that issue.
Well, since I have all the best words and the most beautiful words, I will say, and the most beautiful words here are not Chevron and Auer. Those are the two cases by which the courts have deferred to agencies. Those are very ugly words for those of us who live every day in the trenches of regulatory policy, whereas Hayek said that the future of our liberties really are being decided. It's that fight.
The fourth branch of government as almost a subset of the executive branch.
Exactly. And so there are really two issues here. One is, do the courts play a role in checking the agencies? And the platform talks about this. It says the right thing on a high level, that courts should interpret laws as written rather than allowing agencies to rewrite those laws to suit the administration. That's exactly right. But unfortunately, the platform doesn't single out the bill that has been proposed that would actually address that problem. And that might not be unusual because, of course, there are lots of things said in the platform that are not tied to specific legislation.
The bill can be amended, which would then make the platform look silly if it turns out to be a bad bill.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Except that in the other paragraph, the platform does actually endorse a specific piece of legislation, which is a good idea. It would require, it's called the RAINS Act, it would require that major regulations with an impact over a certain amount of money would require congressional approval. It's a good idea, but frankly, if you were going to prioritize these two, you would pick the one that we talked about first, the one that reins in the deference to agencies. That would do a lot more, in my opinion, than the RAINS Act, which wouldn't apply to the vast majority of regulations. So you have to wonder here who's really paying attention to this and how much detail they understand. The other thing that's missing here is what we really need, frankly, is for a president to do what President Carter started to do in the late 1970s, which is to reassess how agencies work, shut down some of them, maybe rearrange others, but ask, do their underlying standards make sense? The Carter-era Democrats did that for the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC had gone crazy with their concept of unfairness, and Congress forced them to rein that in. That's the kind of thing that needs to happen now, and that's not been mentioned in the platform.
Well, let's go ahead and try to do like a lightning round of the rest of the topics here. One that I definitely want to spend a little bit of time on is trade, because Trump has really differentiated himself as a Republican as kind of anti-free trade. He's, you know, taken the Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, you know, anti-NAFTA, anti-Trans-Pacific Partnership, really started to talk about the importance of America first and buying American products and protecting American companies from foreign competition. Now, that all sounds like an economic podcast, but obviously trade affects the internet. And we're talking about digital trade. We are talking about free speech. And that's why it should be particularly concerning if we're going to strike such a protectionist America first note. What should tech companies take away from that, Barron?
Well, good and bad. The good is that there's a sentence or two in there that very clearly makes that point and says that censorship constitutes a trade barrier for U.S. companies in countries like China.
True.
Right? That's absolutely right. The problem is that it's so narrowly put that it's not really clear here that, in fact, it's not just direct outright censorship like in China that constitutes a trade barrier. It's regulation of the internet around the world. The Europeans, we've done shows about Privacy Shield and that fight. The Europeans have been trying to limit the flow of data to the U.S. and then try to craft a new agreement to deal with it.
Or just extract revenue by fining American companies.
Yeah. Other countries like Brazil and Russia are requiring that data be stored in their country. That's not censorship as such. It certainly facilitates it. But the point is, these limits on cross-border data flows are the real issue. Now, the Democratic platform gets this. They have a sentence that makes that very clear. And this has been an area where Democrats and Republicans have worked together. John Thune, who's the Republican chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, Ron Wyden, probably the most pro-tech Democrat in the Senate, actually got language into the Trade Promotion Authority that required that these issues be addressed. So it's another missed opportunity to both develop the concept fully and also point out that there is room for common ground here.
And there's probably a really tricky issue because Trump is so outspoken about trade and other Republicans haven't really joined that. I mean, people like Paul Ryan and like you said, John Thune, like, yes, they might reluctantly swallow the pill and vote for Donald Trump, but they haven't necessarily adopted all of his positions. Now, let's get to the privacy, encryption, civil liberties bucket, because this is always a mixed bag when you're dealing with Republicans and Democrats, because you have, it doesn't fall along party lines necessarily. So you have your pro-civil liberties Republicans like Daryl Issa, and you have your pro-civil liberties Democrats like Ron Wyden. But then you have your Dianne Feinstein Democrat, who's like the most national security, you know, anti-encryption that you could imagine.
Pro-government, you might say.
And right, and her colleague and her Republican counterpart, Richard Burr. So this is always an interesting issue because it does not fall along these lines. It more falls along the lines of doves and hawks when it comes to national security. So Barron, let's start with encryption. Security. We're talking about the right of Americans to secure their communications by using encryption. Where does the platform get this right? Where do they go astray?
Well, okay, so just big step back. Fourth Amendment. The platform quotes the Fourth Amendment, which is great.
And warrant requirements.
And the idea that the warrant requirement is the crown jewel of our civil liberties is something we've been saying for years. And yet somehow the platform then just uses that to veer into aerial surveillance. Like, they don't say black helicopters, but you sort of have that mental image when you read it. And they fail to mention that the actual Fourth Amendment fight is one about email protection for stored data. That's a live fight that's been going on since 2010. There's another fight that hasn't really gone anywhere about geolocation data, the location data that's generated by your phone. And the platform weirdly misses that point. It talks about the government requiring surveillance devices in our daily lives. That issue, like the Fairness Doctrine, has already been settled. The Supreme Court's 2012 Jones decision said that if you plant a tracking device on someone, that's covered by the Fourth Amendment. So, and it's especially weird here that the platform didn't get this right, because this was a wonderful opportunity to highlight where Republicans have been pro-tech. Republicans led the charge on the email protection for warrant, the warrant protection for email since 2010. And it's been the White House that has frustrated them by standing up for regulatory agencies that want to carve out. So again, it's kind of amateur hour. I mean, if they were really paying attention, if they understood this, they could have made both a solid constitutional civil liberties point and taken a shot at Democrats, and they didn't do either one.
And you can probably say the same thing for how they handled encryption, right?
Yeah. So on encryption, they get part of it right. So it's absolutely, quote, crucial to our digital economy. And even better, they affirm that, quote, citizens must retain the right to communicate with each other free from unlawful intrusion. So that's great. And they also know that there are trade-offs here. And that's true. And I think that the platform is right that this is ultimately needs to be addressed by Congress, which is a point that Justice Alito made in that 2012 decision, saying we need legislation generally here. But then things get a little weird. So it's vague, and it's so vague that it leaves enough room to read in whatever you want. So you could read that language to think that a backdoor would be okay, even though that effectively abolishes end-to-end encryption.
Yeah, think about WhatsApp Basically you and your friend on WhatsApp are the only ones that could see it. So if WhatsApp had to keep a copy, that would defeat the purpose of the end-to-end encryption.
Yeah, so the platform just doesn't get that the real framing here is not privacy versus security, but different kinds of security, and that those are the trade-offs, and that specifically, as we have said, you can have an absolute right to use end-to-end encryption, and yet still recognize that when it comes to the security features on devices, it's all shades of gray.
Like when there's a dead terrorist and we're trying to get into his phone. And those are the areas where it's not an absolute binary end-to-end versus no end-to-end. It's basically, what can a court legally require of a company in terms of assisting them?
Well, and also things like, okay, so how many password attempts before the phone wipes the data? And when it wipes the data, is it totally inaccessible to law enforcement or just inaccessible to hackers? You can regulate that. And I'm not saying that I have an easy answer for how to do it, but that's different from the issue of encryption. And the platform really missed the point here by failing to distinguish between those two things and making it sound like the trade-offs here are really about encryption itself. So they're falling into the trap that Apple has set.
I'd say there's no better way to wrap up than to discuss the final frontier. Let's do a fun one. Let's do space exploration. This was in the platform in 2012. It was in the platform again in 2016. Barron, you are, in addition to the CTO of the Republican Party, a longtime space lawyer. Yes, that's a thing. So, Barron, what was your reaction to the Republican platform on space?
We talk a lot on the show about the basic clash of visions here, not being between left and right, but being between the stasis mentality and technocrats who think that a big program is the right way to do things from the top down on the one hand, and those people are on both political parties. And then on the other hand, people who really want bottom-up solutions, who are more dynamist and who realize that the future is messy, right? So that's what tech freedom's about. We're fundamentally dynamist. And so I cringe at nothing more so than when you hear people talking about the Apollo program. There was a lot of talk about that last night at the convention. Because this is, of course, tying up to the anniversary of the Apollo landing. So everyone in both parties has long been obsessed with the idea, if we could put a man on the moon, surely we could, you know, do something about encryption or
surely
whatever.
Surely we could fix the DC Metro.
Yeah, or cancer or whatever. It's the ultimate technocratic delusion. But look, as somebody who's been in the space advocacy movement for over a decade, I got to tell you, I'm not a big fan of the Apollo project. Because what did it get us? It got us a lot of excitement. Some stimulation, I'm sure, for education and for interest in these areas, maybe some technology that would not have been developed otherwise. But what it did not get us was a sustainable presence beyond Earth orbit. And why? Because it was not about lowering the costs of getting to space. It wasn't about building a value chain. It wasn't about enabling other people to do things. It was about the government putting people on the moon. So when Newt Gingrich talks about a moon base, he's basically talking about the Wernher von Braun approach. You know, he was building rockets for the Germans. He'd do anything he could for that Mars rocket, which he kept working on, even though the SS came and kept telling him, you're supposed to be building, you know, the V-2 to hit Britain. No, I mean, he wasn't interested in that. He just wanted the big government rocket. And so you see this once again here. The platform talks about how we need to do more missions. We need to fly more instead of focusing on the good part of what the platform notes, which is the public-private partnerships that NASA has used to get companies like SpaceX to become suppliers, that was started in the Bush administration. It was greatly accelerated under the Obama administration by smart Democrats who understood that NASA can't do this on its own, that NASA needs new space companies who really disrupt the business of space. And I just would close by saying, remember, Elon started SpaceX not because he wanted to make money in the launch market, but because he wanted to go to Mars. But he was smart enough to realize that that was never going to happen unless you lowered launch costs and you built a value chain in space. And so that's what's missing here. Instead, you see this empty rhetoric about missions and all that stuff that's really the old space NASA industrial complex way of thinking about things.
Well, that's it for today's show. For more on the GOP platform and tech freedoms, obviously, much desired reaction. See our previous episode, one before this one, where we do a deep dive into internet governance and the U.S., quote, giving up control of the internet, as some of the Republicans have warned. And that episode is actually almost as long as this one, and it's only one issue. So imagine that. But then also for more on this issue.
But it's way funnier.
Oh, definitely. Also for more on this issue, basically, we have this in written form. Barron put together a blog post that goes through all of the sections that relate to tech and his take, the good, the bad, and the vague. And we link to that in today's show notes. And if you're on our mailing list, you receive that today in your mailbox. And then we'll also probably be doing more episodes as the election ramps up and tech becomes a focus. Hopefully it does. So that's it for today again. Barron, thank you for joining us. And you just accepted a role in the IT department at Trump Tower, right? So congratulations, Barron. This is a real step in your career.
But Hillary is going to defend my right to be unionized and to have full employee status.
Excellent. Good to hear. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review. I keep saying that, but you guys aren't doing it, so freaking do it, okay? Otherwise, I'm going to have the Trump FCC come after you.
And Coulter.
Yeah, it helps others find the show. That's really why we want to do it. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.